This is episode 415. Tis the season to be thirsty. Whether it be Christmas, Easter, New Year's, or even just Friday, do you drink a little more than you should, a little too much alcohol? Like a few drinks every couple of days, or even a daily glass of wine that sometimes turns into a bottle? If any of that feels all too familiar, then this conversation is worth a listen, because I speak with someone who is an expert in helping people ditch the alcohol and create a life they love. I'm talking about Sarah Rusbach, who is the author of the best-selling book, Beyond Booze. She's helped thousands of people achieve an alcohol-free life, and today we're talking about how you can navigate Christmas and the holiday season without making it an entire month of hangovers that you hated yourself for the entire way through. So if you want to permanently change your relationship with alcohol, then let's dive in.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Welcome to today's How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast episode. This year, it's my mission to coach 500 people to get control of their sugar cravings and sugar binges so they can stop yo-yo dieting, stop obsessing about food, and finally create a body that they feel confident being in. If that resonates with you in any way, the link is down in the show notes or the caption below. Scroll down there, click the link, chat to me or some of my team, and we can get you in and working on that kind of stuff. Now, to introduce a friend of mine that has been on the show a bunch of times now, she's basically a regular or a local or however you want to put it, but Sarah Rusbach is here. Now, along with her authoring her amazing Beyond Booze book, she's also a multi-award-winning health and well-being coach, an accredited grey area drinking coach, a menopause coach, and a speaker where she often shares about her own journey to sobriety and the impact of alcohol on mental health. So Sarah, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm so well, Matty. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking. I'm excited. Lots of big changes happening in my life in the next few months. But as we were just chatting about before, and you are well ahead of me in that journey, so I'm coming to you for all the advice on that journey. But I guess the big conversation point at this time of year, though, is that it tis the season to be thirsty. And so whether that be food, whether that be alcohol, whatever it is. So I guess maybe a good place for us to start chatting alcohol-related conversation is Christmas time and alcohol.
Yeah, and do you know what, Matty? When I was reflecting on this before we went live and my drinking, I remember in December 2018, I was having extreme problems with women's stuff, with menstrual cycles. I'd gone to my naturopath and he did a hormone test. And I remember him phoning me, and it was December, and he said to me, Sarah, your estrogen is so high, it's off the chart. We really need to get on top of this. We need to clean your liver out and you need to take a break from booze. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, it's December. How on earth are you thinking that I'm going to be taking a break from booze in December? I am ramping up, my love. And so, yeah, I was reflecting on that because obviously that's very different to the woman I am today. But I just remember my horror at the thought of having to change my drinking in the month of December, because of all the months to change your drinking, December is not it, or so I thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the same with food, right? Is that this is the month or December or even late November that we start to use all of those, as I termed before, slippery excuses, where we use an excuse for something that isn't quite yet an excuse yet because the event or the month or the date or the thing that gives you permission is nearby. And it's like, oh, it's almost December. So we can ramp up the eating and the drinking for a month or more. Or it's New Year's, or, you know, this is going to happen one time in my life till next year. And so sometimes we can drink or eat, you know, as much as we would have in the past 3 months or longer in like 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah, it's astonishing, isn't it? Because I used to always think like December, for people who are grey area drinkers like me, it was the only month of the year where all the non-grey area drinkers were also happy to get pissed all the time. So you never felt guilty for drinking because like everyone was drinking. It was a completely acceptable time of year to start drinking late morning. It was completely acceptable to drink with breakfast on Christmas Day. And so for people who have any kind of dysfunctional relationship with alcohol, it's kind of like, okay, the gloves are off. I am ready to go. I am rolling up my sleeves. And my goodness, I am so glad that that is not me anymore.
Yeah, well, what leads one to being in a position to not want to do that anymore? Because it's so rooted in our social etiquette or social expectation or familial expectation that at that time of year, this is the mechanism or the tool that we use in order to socially connect. And it's almost like part of our joint suffering that everybody has a hangover together, you know? And so we get to join each other in the pain of having to drink our woes away because the woes suck, but then also having to wake up tomorrow and deal with the hangover together. And it's like this really connecting experience. So it's really hard to get to a point where it's like, I want to break away from that. So what got you to that point where you're like, I don't want to do this anymore?
I think it was a combination of a few things, but I think it was just getting to that point of A, realizing moderation does not work for me and did not work for me. And that actually it was easier for me to have none than it was to have one. Because as soon as I had one, it was like, you know, that saying, if you open the door an inch, it will fly open a mile. That was how it was with me. When it was a firm no, I don't drink, alcohol's not on the table, it was kind of like there was no negotiation around it. That was it. Whereas with moderation, as soon as I had a little bit of booze in, it was like, oh, you could have another one. I know you said you weren't going to, but there's always a reason why you couldn't. If you have one tomorrow, you can just not drink tomorrow. And there was just this constant negotiation. And so moderation didn't work. And once I realized that, I had two options. And one was to carry on drinking like I always had, which was increasingly impacting my mental health, my physical health. I mentioned earlier, my hormones were all over the place. My estrogen was off the charts. I was putting on weight. I was having astonishingly heavy periods. I was suffering estrogen dominance. I was constantly had like dull gray skin. I had spots all along my jaw. I wasn't sleeping. I had low energy. And on the outside, no one realized that any of this was really going on because I drank like most people around me. But on the inside, I was starting to notice more and more that this fun party habitual practice actually wasn't that anymore. But it's really hard because everyone around you is saying, you have to keep drinking. That's the only way to have fun. That's the only way to relax. That's the only way to socialize. So there's this real cognitive dissonance that goes on for a while. But in the end, it was just this true awakening to the fact that everything in my life is better when I don't drink. My energy is better. My self-talk is better. My anxiety reduces. I'm sleeping through the night. I show up as the mum I want to be. And at the end of the day, there comes a decision to make. And it is, which version of me do I want to show up, particularly over the Christmas season? And I chose the version of me that was happier.
I'm curious. With what you just talked about there, there comes a moment or a decision situation. And I know simply from being at some of your events before and being involved in your world that that moment for some women and men is a really scary, like, life situation, or the kids were in danger. Like, it can really be quite a serious moment that shocks people into this has to change. But I can imagine, well, my assumption is that most people flirt with the idea for a very long time before they actually do it. And do you think that that's just mainly the fear of change, or it's the fear of social ridicule, or, you know, for those people that don't have this shocking single moment event, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I think the research shows that it's between 2 and 4 years for most people from recognizing that they want to make a change to their drinking to successfully changing that. And for most people, that requires them abstaining from alcohol because they also realize that moderation doesn't work. And I think there is such a long period because, you know yourself, Matty, the stages of change that us humans go through, it's behavior change is not simple. It's not straightforward. We don't wake up one day and suddenly identify as a person who doesn't drink alcohol. There's so much of us that's intertwined with our relationship with alcohol, the version of us that we are. Sarah, the party girl. Sarah, the hostess that was always having barbecues with booze flowing all the time. And so there's that. And then there's also the societal conditioning that we have that tells us that you need alcohol to have fun, that alcohol is present at every social occasion, and that there's something wrong with you if you can't moderate your drinking, because everywhere the messaging is drink responsibly, drink in moderation, as if that's easy and as if that it's only weak or shameful or bad people that can't do that. But in actual fact, alcohol is super addictive and a lot of people actually can't drink in moderation. And so again, that's putting the onus on the person. And then there comes a lot of shame with that, but also a lot of people believing, well, that's the goal that I must aspire to. And because the authorities are telling me that's what I must do, then I'm going, okay, well, that must be what I must achieve. If there's something wrong with me, I just have to keep trying harder. But in actual fact, with most of the people I work with, and I've now supported thousands of people to change their relationship with alcohol, it's not about them as individuals. It's so much more than that.
Well, it makes me think about the book you and I were talking about very briefly before we hit record, which was Ultra-Processed People. And very much the narrative of that book in regards to food is this idea that it's mostly the system's fault, right? It's mostly the way that supermarkets are set up, the way that farming subsidies make terrible food easy to manufacture and produce. And so my assumption is that it's, you know, similar in the alcohol world, which is that all of the marketing, all of the addictive coloring in there, you know, and in the food that makes it really appealing to buy and take off the shelf, and the social etiquette around it and the culture that's being created. But the thing that I always run into with these conversations that say, don't worry, it's not about willpower or personal responsibility. The system is at fault. I'm like, I don't have $1 billion to change the system. So I have to come back to personal empowerment.
Totally. And that's why, you know, you and I are so on the same page with how we work and support people, because my message is always, only you can do it, but you can't do it alone.
I like that.
And so getting people to recognize that being part of a group, being part of a community, because we do live in a world that is, you know, plaguing us with advertising and marketing for ultra processed food, for alcohol as the solution to every single one of life's problems. And so coming into a container with other people who are all in that same mindset as you and wanting to change their relationship with alcohol is, I believe, the only way to create long-term change.
Yeah, I totally agree. Coincidentally, I was talking to my community on Monday. Oh my God, that was only yesterday. In regards to this idea of belonging. And unless you're in a container where your evolution is accepted and celebrated, it's very difficult to stay in the container that created the problem and evolve out of it successfully whilst staying in the same social circle. Because your colleagues, your family, you know, all of the people that are a part of the enabling, whether intentional or unintentional, it's very difficult to evolve out of that with no one to lean on that says, hey, I like this new version of you. Actually, we want more of it. And it encourages the blossoming of the new version of the person rather than trying to sort of survive in, you know, as if a flower's growing in a graveyard, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Like someone said to me the other day, you've changed so much. And I was like, well, thank fuck for that, because I'm 48 years old, and how awful would it be if I was still the same as I was when I was 22? Like, we're meant to grow. We're meant to evolve. We are human beings. That is part of the journey of life. And for me, that had to involve a shedding of skin and shedding of my use of alcohol and going on this deeper journey of self-growth and self-discovery that sobriety has given me, because I see so many people in their 40s and 50s trying to hang on to their youth by continuing to live their life like they did then. But we've got to remember, we are aging, our body is aging, we can't metabolize alcohol in the same way in our 40s and 50s, and that doesn't support us to drink in our 40s and 50s like we did in our 20s. But many of us are still doing that because we don't know any other way to live our lives.
Do you ever miss those parts of yourself occasionally, or miss the previous versions of yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that I don't think there would ever be a time that I would go, oh, I wish that I hadn't drank. Because honestly, like, my life was my life. And yeah. I had some freaking awesome experiences going out. I traveled the world. I, you know, all of the things that you do in your 20s and stuff. And it was just those last few years where it passed the tipping point, where it went from being 90% fun and 10% a bit shit to being 80% shit and 20% fun. And when it gets to that point, we have to make a decision. And so going back to what you said before about, yes, some people have big rock bottom moments, but some people don't at all. And I would say most people who are gray area drinkers don't. They just start having this awakening, this realization, this awareness that Yeah, the booze isn't working for me like it used to. It's not fun anymore. It disrupts my sleep. It makes me tired and grumpy the next day. It kills my motivation. It makes my self-talk really negative. It doesn't have to be this big aha moment where we get, you know, something dreadful happens. It can be a slow realization, which is what I see happen for lots of people, and particularly for women in their 40s when they start entering perimenopause, and the mix of alcohol with perimenopause can really exacerbate all of those symptoms as well, that they start going, is this working for me anymore or not? And when we realize it's not, then we have full permission to change.
Yeah, I think that's it's a beautiful moment to arrive at. But the other thing that I see with the people I work with, and maybe it's the same for you, I suspect it is, but is that it's often been so long since somebody or the individual felt good, they don't actually know what it feels like, and their body is so familiar with the sort of, you know, the drudgery of everyday life and the sluggishness of their body and, you know, just feeling kind of gross all of the time, that they begin to come off sugar or come off alcohol and actually feel worse. And there's this period of time where they just feel horrible and they're like, healthy isn't for me. You know, I ate some eggplant and I got bloated and I had diarrhea. So, you know, I should just go back to eating McDonald's. And so that can be really confronting because people are sort of like, they're doing all the things they're told that they should do, but they don't actually feel any better and often feel worse and they don't see results for a little bit of time. And so they're like, why would I do this when I can just escape it all by just having some wine or having some sugar or whatever it might be?
Yeah. And it's really interesting because when I run my alcohol-free challenges, there will be half of the group that will get the benefits really quickly. And they're just jumping in going, oh my God, I slept so well last night. I've got so much energy. My anxiety's disappeared. The sober life is amazing. And then there's the other half that are sitting there with their arms crossed, just like, well, it's shit for me. I still can't sleep. I'm tossing and turning all night. I'm tired all the time. I've got low energy. My mood is really low. Like, I don't understand. How are you feeling so amazing? And it's all to do with, you know, our own unique individual bodies, how long we've been drinking for, how much we were drinking, what age we are, what our metabolism is like, what our liver function is like. And so I always say, like, just go at your own pace, don't compare to others. And instead of feeling like frustrated that you're not experiencing the benefits that some of the other ladies were, just see it as something to look forward to, because you will get there. It just might take some people a little bit longer. And it's really common in the first 2 or 3 weeks of taking a break from booze to actually still be getting all the withdrawal symptoms and still feeling tired, really lethargic, low motivation, low mood. And then after about 3-4 weeks, you generally start to see a shift.
I know that at the start we were talking about, or before we hit record, we're talking about the menopause piece and that sort of weight loss and all the challenges, which sort of are off the back of what you just said there. Is that one of the reasons that your own curiosity was to sort of start looking at menopause and weight loss and nutrition? Because I guess the alcohol sort of opens up this sort of can of worms of like, well, I've got rid of the alcohol, but there's all of these other things that determine my level of sleep or my level of wellness or my level of health. Is that the thing that's sent your own curiosity into like learning more in that world?
Yeah, absolutely. Because there will be some ladies who are full of beans and doing so well as soon as they remove alcohol. And there are others who are really not. But then we've got to look at, well, have you replaced alcohol with sugar? Because we know that a diet that's high in sugar and ultra processed food makes you feel like shit, increases your anxiety and disrupts your sleep. And so, and then we also know that in midlife, in menopause, perimenopause, we've got fluctuating hormones. This drives more anxiety. It can impact our sleep. It can cause aching joints. We're more prone to putting weight on around the tummy. And so I just became so curious at understanding the entire package of a midlife woman's health and well-being and how I can support her through that entire journey, not just only removing alcohol, because alcohol is just one part of the piece. And there are some people that will get very quick benefits from removing alcohol, and there are others that need to look at more than just the alcohol piece.
Yeah, totally. It's a whole package. And when you've been living a particular way for multiple decades, I guess most of the people in that group aware that the short-term 28-day fad diet didn't solve all of their problems, and the, you know, dry July is a good place to start. But if you only do dry July once every year, then you're probably not going to solve your problems either. And so I think that framing of like it's an entire package, and the reality is that each one of those pieces takes the time that it's going to take. And that's not sexy at all.
No, because we just want instant quick results, don't we? And that's how we're all programmed to just go, well, I don't want to have to sit with any discomfort. I want it to be quick. I want it to be instant. I've made up my mind. This is what I want to change. And so, goddamn, it needs to change immediately. And when it doesn't, we just get pissed off and frustrated and resentful. So it's really important to have so much compassion for ourselves through this whole journey of change as well.
Something that that shocked me a little bit was the definition of what a binge drinking situation is. So I'd love to talk about that, because I think Christmas time, Easter time, birthday time, whatever time it is in people's lives, I think it's probably surprising to people that lots of us would be classified, clinically speaking, as a binge drinker. So can we just talk to that?
Yeah, so binge drinking is defined as 6 or more units in one setting. Now, it's important to recognise that one unit is not one drink. So particularly if it's a self-pour drink. And so one unit is probably about a third or a half of a glass of wine that you would pour at home. And sometimes a binge drinking session of 6 units could be 2 large glasses of wine, again, depending on the alcohol volume of that wine, because some wines are 9%, some wines are 14%. So if you're drinking a 14% alcohol wine and you have 2 large glasses, that's a binge drinking session. And the research shows us that binge drinking is a lot more harmful, especially for the liver, 4 times more harmful than drinking that same amount over a few days.
Mum, mother, grandmother, nan, nana, and women with no kids. Have I got your attention? So I want you to imagine something. Go with me here. Imagine a life where even when you wake up tired and the kids are driving you mad and work sucks and things are problematic, that you're still in control of your food and you still make healthy choices without giving up and binging on chocolate and wine and saying, I'll try again tomorrow. It might be hard to imagine, but having freedom with your food is absolutely possible. And it starts by getting 3 things right. 1, having a supportive community, building a strong connection with fellow emotional eating warriors. 2, having the right information delivered in the right way. And 3, having a guide that can shine a light on the right path and have your back along the way. And that's me. Those 3 things are exactly what we've got for you inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group for people just like you wanting to end their emotional eating and feel good in their own skin again. And currently, it's free to join. The link is in the show notes below. If you've struggled with diets or felt powerless around food, you're not alone. But let me assure you, this is a community that understands your battles and is ready to empower you into action. So what can you expect on the inside? Well, we have posts and content that push you a little out of your comfort zone. We do Facebook Lives, have interactive Q&A session, and it's simply a safe space to face your food challenges and be honest without concern of being judged. If you decide to join us, I have a complimentary How to Turn Food into Self-Confidence ebook for you as well, completely free. The Healthy Mums Collective thrives on support, authenticity, and experience-based practices. It's a community, so the beautiful people in it is where the magic comes from. To join us and be a part of that magic, head to the show notes, click the link, breeze through a few quick questions, and you'll be in the Healthy Mums Collective before you know it. Again, the link is in the show notes below. I'll see you in the DMs or on the welcome post in just a few moments.
Yeah, which I mean, yeah, all of the cans and bottles are always 1 point or 2 point or 3 point, whatever standard drink. So it's so easy to accidentally overconsume have more than you are expecting that you're actually having.
Yeah, exactly. And particularly at Christmas time, because it feels like every social event is around catching up over a drink. It feels like even Monday nights, it's okay to drink alcohol in December. Like, who drinks alcohol on a Monday, right? Normally that's the one day that even the hardcore drinkers are like, no, I don't drink on a Monday. And then suddenly it's December and all the rules are out the window and Monday is like Friday. And so we've got to just be really aware that, I was sharing with you before we went live that there's a massive article gone live in the BBC recently where they've been interviewing, young women in the UK with what's known as alcohol-related liver disease and real scarring on the liver caused by alcohol. And these women are young. They're in their early 30s. They're not drinking every day. They're not drinking hard liquor in the morning. They're binge drinking. And the impact that that's having on liver disease and on liver health is really, really bad. And so, again, it's just being mindful. Well, over the Christmas season, does every catch-up have to involve alcohol? Can I meet people and go for a beautiful brunch and breakfast? Can we go for a nice walk and a coffee? Can we go and have a picnic and go kayaking and stand-up paddleboarding? Like, there are lots and lots of things we can do that don't just have to involve going and sitting in the pub drinking.
Yeah, which is just a wild idea in a country that has summer at Christmas time. The idea that you want to be inside in an air-conditioned environment having a nice cold beer is so appealing when it comes to summer. But something I've noticed in the supermarket is how big the flavoured sparkling water section has become. And I know for me personally, like that's the go-to alternative to alcohol, to sugar, to, you know, and there's sugar in some of them, but it's a snack alternative. It's a, you know, binge eating alternative. It's an alcohol alternative. So I think that's something, you know, at least people have got that. And also the non-alcoholic section is getting bigger and bigger as well.
Yeah. And for so many people who are gray area drinkers, the alcohol-free drinks are an absolute, like, the best tool out there, because you're going to a barbecue, you're going to a party, you can take an alcohol-free champagne, you can have an alcohol-free beer. It scratches the itch. No one's questioning what you're drinking because it looks like you're drinking like everybody else. And so I am a high advocate for alcohol-free drinks if you don't find them triggering. There are some people who will find alcohol-free drinks really triggering and could drive cravings for alcohol. But for a lot of the people I work with, they're actually really helpful.
Yeah, that's quite similar to some of the issues people have with natural sweeteners and alternative sweeteners, is that it can trigger their sugar cravings. And it's basically told the body, something sweet, go looking for the sugar, and then the body can't find the sugar. So it basically sends us into this hunt and gather mode of like going to collect something that actually has sugar. Because the signaling's mixed in the brain and the body. It's like, oh, the brain says sugar's coming, but the body says sugar didn't arrive. And so it can totally trigger people to go and do what they're trying to avoid.
Yeah. And I think research has shown that people with very extreme, severe alcohol use disorder will find alcohol-free drinks very triggering. But people in the grey area drinking category tend to find that they're not triggering and they're actually really helpful.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's good. I'm curious as well to go back to that conversation around liver disease, because I think, you know, a lot of the conversation that is had on in many scenarios about alcohol is usually about the social challenges. But as may be obvious to some people, but not others, you know, the physical consequence of putting a toxin or a poison in your body on a regular basis is obviously has all sorts of catastrophic impacts to the longevity of one's life and quality of life experience. And you said that these women that are having these experiences with their liver are much younger than we would have expected. I guess my question is, why do you think it's getting younger, like that we're starting to see these diseases in people? Is that just overconsumption by everybody is increasing?
Yeah, look, I think it's a few reasons. So I think we're living in a world that has normalized alcohol use as the solution to every problem that we experience in life. Had a hard day, have a drink. Had an argument with your partner, have a drink. Had a discussion with your boss that's left you feeling a bit crap, have a drink. Like, fill in the blank, and alcohol is there as the solution. And we've normalized that. Like, I don't remember growing up seeing the level of advertising and marketing for alcohol that you see now, particularly directed towards women. We know that alcohol use disorder in women has increased 87% in the last 30 years. And we know that it's in the last 30 years that Big Alcohol made a direct, specific decision to start targeting women because they weren't making enough money from the sales of alcohol to women. So that was when they segregated their marketing, came up with the Alcopops, and started directly targeting women through the advertising, marketing of you know, the rosé all day, and you know, all of the marketing that we see. But this has not come without its you know, disadvantages, and particularly COVID played a massive part in this. We know the statistics show how much alcohol use increased during COVID, and especially in women. And now we're starting to see the fallout of that. So this new paper that just came out in the UK has said that liver disease is among the top, always among the top three causes of death in women aged 39 to 45. And that just blew my mind because, you know, that liver disease has historically been associated with old men who have been drinking, you know, all of their lives, and then they get liver disease in their 70s or whatever. To see it growing in women in their late 30s, early 40s is really worrying.
Absolutely. That's shocking. But I guess they're eating and living in such a way that it means that the onset of such a disease happens so young. You know, like you said, the quintessential or the stereotypical person is, like, you can imagine somebody super old that's lived a lot of their life already, but these people are, you know, hampering their possibility, I guess, to have babies probably, to, you know, have a normal life. They're probably cutting years off their life for those that aren't passing away. But it's in the top three. Like, that's a crazy number.
Yeah, I know. And what a lot of people don't realize is that alcohol is metabolized completely differently in a woman's body to in a man's body, because women do not produce as much as the enzyme ALDH, alcohol dehydrogenase. So that enzyme has the number one job is to break down and eliminate alcohol from the body as quickly as possible. Men produce more of that. Women have less. And for women, that amount decreases even more as they age. So for every drink that a woman has compared to a man, more alcohol content will enter a woman's bloodstream, which makes her more prone to liver disease, heart disease, cancer, and all of the health impacts of alcohol actually happen quicker in women than in men, because we are not as efficient at removing the toxin that is alcohol from our bodies. But no one was talking about that when they were sat around their big table going, how are we going to make more money from women? Oh, let's start specific advertising campaigns and create drinks that taste like fizzy pop so that we can get more women hooked on alcohol and make more money.
Yeah, and I guess maybe they'll do something similar to Coca-Cola, which is they'll build a gym in a couple of different cities and say, look what we do for health and wellness, and then keep selling you Coca-Cola.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then I did read in the BBC article that they asked the alcohol industry, one of the committees in the alcohol industry, what they thought about and this concerning increase in the rise of liver disease in young women caused by alcohol. And the spokesperson said, oh, yes, but it's important to remember that alcohol is legal and we do always advise to drink responsibly. And it's just like, yeah, so once again, the alcohol industry doesn't take any responsibility for themselves. And because it's legal, therefore, that makes it okay.
Yeah, it's society's set up in a weird way. It's like the downfall of a free market, a free capitalist market, right? There's always a dark side.
Totally.
So with, you know, social events, Christmas and that time of year where you're catching up with all these people you probably only see once a year, and you might feel the pull to be able to get involved in all of the experiences. My question is, how do you put boundaries in place around alcohol?
Yeah, so I think there's a few steps. I think the number one thing that I ask your listeners to consider is what do you want your overriding feeling to be over the next month? So over the festive season, over Christmas, how do you want to feel? Because I don't think many people are going to say tired, anxious, overwhelmed, lethargic, exhausted. Most people are going to say, I want to feel energized. I want to feel happy. I want to feel present to enjoy this time with my loved ones, with my kids. And so when we know how we want to feel, we can work backwards and go, okay, so how does alcohol make me feel right now as the woman I am today? Let's not think about how it made us feel in our 20s. As the woman or man I am today, how does alcohol currently make me feel? How do I feel the next day after a night of drinking? And is that how I want to feel over the festive season? Remembering that we can't bounce back often now like we could all those years ago. And it is going to maybe involve a day of feeling like utter shite, maybe some vomiting, maybe some lying on the sofa, just eating Pringles and watching TV, not being the parent we want to be. Maybe we're having to cancel something the next day because we're feeling so awful. And so again, it's just remembering and also know yourself. So am I someone that just once I get started, there is no stopping me? Or am I someone that finds it quite easy to moderate? Because if you do set yourself the goal of going, right, I'm just going to go and I'm going to have two, And if you know that you're someone that can do that, fine, go for your life. But if you're the person like me, where two is never two and two is nearly always a bottle and sometimes more, then it's about going, okay, so what could I do differently on those nights? What nights could I go and not drink and just still have a great time? Because, you know, I always say, if you need alcohol to enjoy a person or a thing, you don't enjoy that person or that thing. You know, when you are with the people you love, doing the things you love, you don't need alcohol. And if you do, then that's a whole other situation. Come and contact me. We'll do some life coaching and we'll get you sorted there. Because if you actually can go and enjoy anything in your life without alcohol, we need to look at the bigger picture of that.
Yeah, it's wild to me how many years people with food or with alcohol, or, you know, insert challenging, triggering, dopamine addicting thing, how many years people will wrestle with their own psychology about being a moderator and wanting and trying so hard to be so good at moderating their relationship. And they just eventually, they either have to surrender to the fact that they're an abstainer, they're someone that has to draw a hard line, or they accept that this is the way I'm going to feel for the rest of my life. I'd rather not abstain and be slightly miserable forever than give this thing up that I'm so attached to.
Yeah, and that was where I got to, was I remember a dear friend of mine called me out on it, and she just said, why are you fighting so hard to keep this in your life when everything in your life is better without it? And like when someone holds that mirror up to you and asks you that question, it really pauses you, you know, it causes you to pause and to think and to go, right, why am I fighting so hard to keep it in my life? And it's all about beliefs. Because the story I've told myself is that my life is better with it in, but actually the evidence is it's not, because I'm more anxious. I don't sleep. I feel lethargic. I'm putting on weight. I've got no energy. I'm not the mum I want to be. Like, the evidence is that actually it's not worth fighting for. And so it's coming back to asking yourself those questions as well, which are not easy questions to ask ourselves. But I would argue that if we don't ask ourselves the hard questions, we don't create a life we love. And then we just carry on living our life on autopilot, feeling like shit. A year goes by, 5 years goes by, we haven't made any changes. And then blink, it's the end of our life. And we look back and go, I had opportunities to change and I didn't take them. And that was the fear that I had, was I didn't want to feel like I'd missed out on this one opportunity of life. And I'd got to the point where alcohol wasn't adding to my life, it was taking from it.
I'm really interested in your own journey there, where, you know, somebody held that mirror up to you where it was like, everything's better without it. What was the fear of changing? Like, because I find with some people that I work with, simply feeling clear, like not being overwhelmed in their mind, means that they're present with their everyday life. And then they realize that, you know, the thing that they're uncomfortable or trying to run from is maybe a past trauma, or it's their husband that they don't really like, or whatever it is. Were you able to figure out what it was for you? That it's like, yeah, I get that I feel better and feel amazing and I'm clearer, but I'm more present for insert thing I'm really avoiding.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think for me, all the benefits I was getting from alcohol were very internal benefits in terms of how I felt inside, but that didn't correspond with the external version of Sarah that I had created, which was Sarah the party girl, Sarah that always has people to her house every five, you know, every chance she gets to get pissed with and to always have wine in the fridge. And so I felt like I had these two different personalities, because I'd started to get to know this person inside who was a bit more spiritual than she realized, who was a bit more self-connected than she realized, who actually enjoyed time by herself and loved cuddling up with her daughter on a Friday night watching a movie and not being out getting drunk. So I had this, all of these things were happening inside, but the external version of Sarah, I was like, well, how am I going to get these two to merge? Because it felt like they were really far apart, and all the benefits I'd been getting felt very personal and very inside of me, but the external version of me was still Sarah the drinker. And how it was the fear of getting those two to merge, which takes time and takes a long time, but it's absolutely worth it.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. I'm always really curious to know the thing behind the thing. And the same with my clients, you know, that's probably why I do what I do, because the thing behind the thing is, you know, where the real answer lies. And it's often so disconnected for many people from the actual activity. It's got nothing to do with getting drunk all the time. It's got nothing to do with binge eating, it's like, oh, the thing that I'm avoiding or the version of myself that I'm avoiding is because a belief that my mum installed when I was 10, or a situation that happened with a man that, you know, fundamentally changed the way that I see myself. You know, it's getting to that layer of depth. I think that we realize that we actually, it's not the alcohol, and maybe even it's not the marketing. Maybe even I'm actually really strong and capable, but there's just something inside me that's really scary, or a version of me that needs attention that I fear helping because I don't know what the consequence will be. And I think when we deal with that core layer, you can throw all the marketing in the world at some people and it's like, whatever, you know, I've sorted myself out, which is the whole point of all of this personal development, right? Is that you're invincible, you know, in some aspects.
Totally. And that's, you know, that the book that I wrote and all the work I do now is on how do you create a life where you don't want or need alcohol, because you've done the work on yourself. So your need for alcohol pretty much disappears. And that work will be different for everyone, because everyone says to me, but what's the work? What's the work I need to do? And for some people, it might be leaving a bad marriage. For some people, it might be going into therapy. For some people, it might be leaving their job and retraining to do something else. For some people, it might be working on a completely dysregulated nervous system. And it's different for everybody, but we've got to get to know what it is for us. Like, what's the alcohol masking? Because when we can peel that back and deal with the root cause, the need for alcohol disappears.
I like it. And I know that you've worked, as you said, thousands of people. But for anyone listening that's like, I need to begin this journey, I've been wrestling with the idea, or I've tried a few stints of going off alcohol and haven't quite made it stick, where can everybody find you online? How can they get into some of your monthly challenges that you do?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I'm not sure when this episode will go out, but I'm assuming sometime in December, right? And so it's about recognizing that December's probably not a time to create change for the first time. And maybe we are going to be still, you know, drinking or eating or whatever that might be. But recognize what prompts you to drink. Maybe look at drinking less, having alcohol-free days, noticing how it makes you feel when you do drink, but also noticing how it makes you feel when you don't drink, and start creating that information and building that information for your life so that you've got information that can help you make future decisions. And then if you do want to get support to change your drinking, I will have an alcohol-free challenge for women that starts on the 6th of January, which is 30 days coming into a community and being in that echo chamber with other women from all over the world who are doing it together. And every day you get daily support from me, you get guest expert interviews. And we don't just work on taking alcohol out, we work on how can I create a life I love so much I don't need alcohol, because that's the missing piece for so many women. And, you know, when I've done, I did a poll in my big Facebook community of 20,000, and I asked, why do you drink? And there were three big reasons, and it was boredom, stress, and loneliness. And if we can get to the root cause of why someone is drinking in a gray area, drinking dysfunctional manner, then we deal with that. And like I said, the need for alcohol becomes less anyway. And that's the work I love doing, is helping women get to know themselves better. Because when we're drinking, we're often so disconnected from ourselves.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. And for anybody that is listening and interested, the links will be down in the caption of the show note below. So just scroll down, click the link, jump into Sarah's world. She's a fantastic human, and I'm lucky to call her my friend. But before we finish the quintessential How to Not Get Sick and Die final question of every single episode, what is one piece of health information that you wish more people knew about, maybe specific to this time of year?
That drinking alcohol will make you feel like shit and ruin your Christmas, and that you can have an amazing Christmas day, waking up in the morning, feeling energized, feeling happy, feeling positive, being present, having some alcohol-free champagne, having some great food, and trying doing it differently and see how that goes.
Fantastic piece of information to tell more people about. So thank you. I appreciate it. And appreciate you. Appreciate your time. And I hope you have a fantastic Christmas and New Year.
Same to you, Maddie. Thanks for having me.
No worries. See ya.
How
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember, too, that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.